Ahoy, crew members. Thanks for remaining aboard ship, and welcome to installment number 10 of the episodes created just for you, part of the supporting crew. When I first decided to do these bonus episodes, I was thinking that I'd just cut out some details from the main episodes and use this outlet as a way to share deeper detail with supporters. That's proved a bit more difficult than I anticipated, though. I've had a hard time leaving the detail out of the main podcast feed and then figuring out how to cut out details and form them into an intriguing discussion in their own right, divorced from the greater context of the main podcast. So I've really started taking minor points that piqued my interest, but that we just mention or gloss over on the main feed, and I've used those topics as a springboard to then research more and produce bonus episodes that are mostly self-contained, but that do still relate a bit to our main episode topics. That holds true for today's episode once again. That's the only reason that I've really bothered elaborating my thought process here at the beginning, frankly. So, if you've listened to episode 33 of the main podcast feed, you may or may not recall that we mentioned the coins minted by a specific city, the coins from Aegina, and how the image that came to symbolize the city there was the sea turtle that they cast onto their coins. We've mentioned other cities' coins on previous episodes and how they each tended to use a unique identifier that would help people immediately recognize the origin of the coin, just like coins still work today. We've mentioned coins from the Hellespont and Black Sea regions, as Greek cities and Ionia were earlier in their adoption of minted coinage than were Greek cities further to the west. It was a combination of one of these coin images and then another story from a previous member episode that got me wondering about a specific sea creature and just how much it related to Greek history and mythology in the maritime sense. That's really what motivated the episode topic here today. So the coins from Byzantium were known to have images of the dolphin on one side. And in our episode about wine in the Greek world, we saw a story involving Dionysus and how he turned a band of brigand sailors into dolphins. This is a Greek myth that connects the sea with wine, but also with this graceful sea creature that we will now consider a bit further today. I don't really have a narrative structure, per se. I just was intrigued by the other instances where dolphins played a part in Greek mythology, and what it maybe can tell us about the Greek relationship to the sea. So we can look at a few different stories and ideas today, and I'll try to string them together in a more or less logical manner. The problem there is, of course, where exactly to start? Maybe the best place to start is where my reading started, and then maybe we can follow a thread from there. For me, it started with this idea that the Greek and Roman writers of astronomy and myth wrote about the constellation Delphinus. So, although the dolphin was a sea creature, the Greeks had already enshrined it in the sky as well. We've talked in general about the rise of celestial navigation as it was first done by the Phoenicians, and then eventually spread to the Greeks as well. So we know in what high regard the Greek philosophers and sailors both held the stars above. The constellation Delphinus wasn't a constellation that was integral to navigation, especially navigation using the stars at sea during night. This constellation is one of the smaller constellations in the Greek lists, and it's still small in relation to the 88 modernly recognized constellations. It really doesn't contain any bright stars to speak of either, so when the constellation is mentioned in the Greek and Roman literature, it's mentioned in a list and in relation to the mythological story that the Greeks connected to the constellation. The connection between ancient oral myth and the constellations as they categorized them and assigned them images, what we often call star myths, this whole topic is really fascinating to me, and maybe that's somewhat of an explanation about why we keep returning to mythology so much on the podcast, at least up to this point. That being said, I'm by no means an expert on the intersection between myth and star lore, especially when you start trying to trace it back into prehistory. So let's see what was actually written down in some of these ancient Greek constellation lists and myths, as they were connected to the stars and, by extension, the sea. The most explicitly stated connection between the dolphin in Greek myth and the inclusion of this sea creature in the catalog of constellations comes from a Roman-era work called De Astronomica. Authorship is disputed, but it's generally credited to a writer or writers called Hyginus or Pseudo-Hyginus. Essentially, this work is a description of the 48 constellations as they were listed by Ptolemy, who was the Greco-Roman astronomer of the 2nd century AD. The work De Astronomica is basically a catalog of brief astronomical description and then very heavy on the Greek and Roman myths connected to each constellation. So for our talk today, it is very on point. Here's what Hyginus had to write, at least in part, about the dolphin. We'll touch on the other points he makes, but we will draw our further inspiration from other sources. To get us started, here is the passage from Hyginus. He writes, quote, Eratosthenes and others give the following reason for the dolphins being among the stars. Amphitrite, when Neptune desired to wed her, and she preferred to keep her virginity, fled to Atlas. Neptune sent many to seek her out, among them a certain Delphin, who, in his wandering among the islands, came at last to the maiden, persuaded her to marry Neptune, and himself took charge of the wedding. In return for this service, Neptune put the form of a dolphin among the constellations. More than this, we see that those who make statues of Neptune place a dolphin either in his hand or beneath his foot, a thing they think will please the god especially. If we view Poseidon and Neptune as the Greek and Roman sides of the same deity coin, which I think is largely fine to do, then we can see that the Greek god of the sea placed the dolphin among the stars as a reward for the dolphin's assist in persuading Amphitrite to marry Poseidon. I can't help but think of the dolphin as Poseidon's wingman here, despite the 20th century origin of that term, and then the evolution of the term into the slang that it's commonly used today. That concluding reference to how artists include dolphins in statues of the god Neptune also puts me in mind of the enormous statue of Neptune that stands along the boardwalk in Virginia Beach, Virginia, here in the United States. I always loved heading out that direction when I lived in that area, both to be by the ocean, of course, but also to see the striking statue of the god of the sea. And it is true to this day still that artists included dolphins and sea turtles in this depiction of the Roman god in Virginia, and it's commonly done in other depictions that are made this day still. Now, I can't say whether they included dolphins in the depiction out of a desire to please Neptune, or merely because they thought that it would look more oceanic, but either way, their inclusion of the dolphin is telling and interesting that it continues to this day. This whole myth about the dolphins aiding Poseidon is echoed in a poem written by the Greek poet Oppian. It's called Haliudica, and it's a 3,500-word poem or so, all about fishing and the creatures of the sea as the Greeks understood such things during the Roman era again. Since this is a member episode, and I try to keep things a bit looser, I hope you don't mind if I read the paragraph from Oppian here as well. He does give a slightly different take on the nature of Amphitrite's willingness to become the bride of Poseidon. He writes, quote, "The Delphines, or dolphins, both rejoice in the echoing shores and dwell in the deep seas, and there is no sea without Delphines. For Poseidon loves them exceedingly, inasmuch as when he was seeking Amphitrite, the dark-eyed daughter of Nereus, who fled from his embraces, Delphines marked her hiding in the halls of Oceanus and told Poseidon. And the god of the dark hair straightway carried off the maiden and overcame her against her will. Her he made his bride, queen of the sea, and for their tidings he commended his kindly attendants and bestowed on them exceeding honor for their portion." So, as we said beforehand, a slightly different take. To conclude our look at the connection between the dolphin of the sea and its constellation in the night sky, here is a poem by Ovid, translated here to give us a bit more musical take on the dolphin and why it was set in the stars. Ovid is recounting this myth because he's writing about festivals that took place at various parts of the year. So since this constellation was about to disappear from view for a period of weeks, starting at the beginning of February in the Julian calendar, he seizes on that small connection to write this poem about the dolphin. It touches on the myth that we've already discussed, but it more heavily focuses on a second myth, one that we will continue on to discuss further. So here's the poem. "The dolphin that you saw lately, studded with stars, will escape your gaze on the following night. He was a happy go-between in love's intrigues, or he carried the Lesbian lyre and its master. What land or sea does not know of Arion? He could hold back the running waters with his singing. Often the wolf seeking a lamb was halted by his voice. Often the lamb stopped in fleeing the ravening wolf. Often hare and hounds rested in the same covert, and the deer on the rock stood still near the lioness. And the chattering crow perched with Pallas's owl, without a quarrel, and the dove united with the hawk. They say that Diana has often stood entranced at your music, tuneful Arion, as if it were played by her brother's hand. Arion's fame had filled the cities of Sicily and charmed the Italian shores with the sound of his lyre. Traveling back from there, he boarded a ship carrying with him the wealth won by his art. Unhappy one, perhaps you feared the wind and waves, but the sea, in truth, was safer for you than your ship. Since the steersman stood there with naked blade, and the rest of that crew of conspirators were armed, why draw that blade? Seaman, steer your wandering vessel. That weapon is not appropriate in your hands." Trembling with fear, Arion said, "I don't plead for life, but let me take up my lyre and play a little." They granted it, laughing at the delay. He took the wreath that might have graced your tresses, Phoebus, put on his robe, twice dipped in Tyrian purple, and, plucked by his thumb, the strings gave out their music. Such a melody as the swan's mournful measures when the cruel shaft has transfixed its brow. At once he plunged, fully clothed, into the waves. The water, leaping, splashed the sky-blue stern. Then, beyond belief, they say a dolphin yielded its back to the unaccustomed weight. Sitting there, Arion gripped the lyre and paid his fare in song, soothing the ocean waves with his singing. The gods see good deeds. Jupiter took the dolphin and ordered its constellation to contain 9 stars. That, then, is the poet Ovid's take on the reason why the dolphin was rewarded with 9 stars to form a constellation. But it really seems like he's conflating 2 separate myths. The myth that was more commonly associated with the constellation of the dolphin was the first one that we consider today, where the dolphin aided Poseidon in his pursuit of the nymph Amphitrite. The second myth was the one that Ovid spent almost all of those lines describing, so let's go ahead then and dig into it a little bit further and see what other ancient writers had to say about it. The earliest source to really elaborate on this myth is Herodotus. It seems as well that most sources that discuss the myth and even give their own spin on it after Herodotus were probably drawing their info from him, although it was a popular myth in ancient Greece and may have been well known simply by word of mouth, let alone through its inclusion in the writings of the father of history. Now, the focus of this story is Arion, Tuneful Arion, as he was called by Ovid in that poem above. He earned the adjective tuneful there because he was known around the Greek world as the best lyre player of his time. Herodotus paints him as a historical character. He's said to have lived during the life of the Corinthian tyrant Periander, who ruled from roughly 625 to 587 or so BCE. I really haven't spent a lot of time digging into whether Arion really may have been a historical figure, but my suspicion is that this is probably another instance where myth and fact get melded into an amalgam that we probably can't ever fully separate again. For example, Arion was said to have gained his musical ability from Orpheus himself, and I don't recall ever seeing an argument that Orpheus existed anywhere other than in myth, but because Herodotus so strongly states that Arion was a historical character who lived during certain years, it's possible that Arion may have been real, and then the mythology grown from there. So then, although we've heard that poem from Ovid already, if you don't mind, I'm going to read the passage from Herodotus to put some more meat on the bones of this story, where dolphins again make a heroic appearance. Herodotus writes in Book 1 of his Histories, quote, "Periander, the man who informed Thrasybulus of the oracle, was the son of Cypselus and tyrant of Corinth." The Corinthians tell a story, and the people of Lesbos agree with them, about the most amazing thing that happened during his lifetime. Arion of Methymna was carried upon a dolphin and set on shore at Tynaron. Arion was a lyre player, second to none at that time, as well as the first person known to us to have created and named the dithyramb, and to have produced it in Corinth. They say that this Arion spent much of his time at the court of Periander, but longed to sail to Italy and Sicily. He finally did so, and after he had earned a large amount of money there, he decided to return to Corinth. So he sailed out from Teras, and since he trusted no people more than Corinthians, he hired a boat of Corinthians. When these men were out at sea, they plotted to throw Arion overboard in order to get his money. Once Arion perceived this, he begged them to take his money but spare his life. But he could not persuade them. The sailors ordered him to kill himself if he would have a grave on land, or to get it over with immediately and to jump into the sea. Arion, made desperate by their decision, asked one request of them. Would they permit him to sing for them from the stern in full costume? He promised that as soon as his song was ended, he would kill himself. Delighted at the prospect of hearing the best of all singers, the sailors retreated from the stern to the middle of the ship. Arion put on his costume, picked up his lyre, stood on the deck, and performed the high-toned hymn. When he finished the song, he leapt into the sea, still in full costume, and the men sailed back to Corinth. But according to what they say, a dolphin took up Arion on its back and brought him to shore at Tynaron. There, he stepped off the dolphin and made his way back to Corinth in his costume, and when he arrived, he explained all that had happened. In disbelief, Periander did not allow Arion to leave, but kept him in custody while watching attentively for the crew of sailors. When they arrived in Corinth, he had them summoned and inquired whether they could tell him anything about Arion. They told him that Arion had been safe in Italy and prospering in Teres when they had left. As they were speaking, Arion appeared before them, just as he was when he jumped overboard. And in their shock, when cross-examined, they could no longer deny what had happened. The people of both Corinth and Lesbos tell this story, and there is a dedication by Arion at Tynaron, a small bronze statue of a man upon a dolphin. Really, there isn't too much to elaborate on by way of explanation. Herodotus, as he always does, did a great job of describing the story in the necessary detail, although I'm sure he didn't need me to say it. There is one further interesting mention in connection with that story, though. It relates to that final sentence that mentions a bronze statue of a man on a dolphin that was supposedly dedicated by Arion himself to commemorate his salvation by the dolphins. Pausanias is our source here. He wrote this following passage in his travel account of Greece in the 2nd century AD. His account would basically describe cities and their historical and cultural significance, along with geography and other factoids, so really it's very similar to travel writing as we know it today. Anyhow, here is that passage, and do keep in mind that he's mentioning this statue in the same city that Herodotus described it, but Pausanias was writing 6 centuries later and claims to have seen it for himself. He writes, quote, "Among other offerings on Tainarum is a bronze statue of Arion, the harper, on a dolphin." Herodotus has told the story of Arion and the dolphin as he heard it in his History of Lydia. "I have seen the dolphin at Porosilini that rewards the boy for saving his life. It had been damaged by fishermen, and he cured it. I saw this dolphin obeying his call and carrying him wherever he wanted to ride on it." There is a spring also on Tainarum, but now it possesses nothing marvelous. Formerly, as they say, it showed harbors and ships to those who looked into the water. These sights in the water were brought to an end for good, and all by a woman washing dirty clothes in it." Now, that final paragraph, totally unrelated, but I found it a little funny. The moral is, I guess, don't wash your dirty clothes in random enchanted springs. So try to remember that just in case you ever find yourself in a similar situation, I guess. Okay, I think our talk so far has followed a rather loose but traceable progression. I've just been caught in two minds about whether to end with Pausanias or not. We saw how the dolphin was enshrined in the stars by the ancient Greeks, and we've seen some of the myths involved. But there really is a close connection in the Greek mind between dolphins, the sea, and the gods, or religion, I guess we can call it. And although I do want to take a look at some of those ideas, I think it's better to get this shorter episode out to you now, and then leave room for us to return to this discussion at some point in the near future. There's a rather lengthy passage in Plutarch that has a lot to say about things along these lines, And then there's, of course, the hymn to Apollo, which will give us an en route to see how the dolphin was associated with the god Apollo in some places around Greece. We've already discussed the role of dolphins in the hymn to Dionysus in our member episode about wine and the sea, where Dionysus turns the pirates who tried to rob him into dolphins. That shows that the other gods in the Greek world also have a connection to dolphins and various other ideas there too, so we will take a bit more time in a future episode to look at all of that. This episode here has been a bit shorter, which I trust is alright with you all, and I'll keep trying to shorten things up a little bit so we have content more regularly. Other than more content and having it come out on a more regular basis, I'm always open to communication from you, our crew. I'd love to hear from you about what you like, what you don't like, or what you might be interested in hearing more about. I believe I mentioned last time that I've toyed with the idea of doing a read-through, a book club type idea, a series going through the Aubrey Maturin historical fiction books written by Patrick O'Brien. I've finished the first two books of the series, and I've personally really enjoyed them, even though there are a ton more left. They are so detailed at times, though, that it's occasionally hard to follow. And I thought that a read-through to really dig into the descriptions of naval warfare, life at sea, even the historical context of the period in which these stories are set, I thought that that might be enjoyable, a decent change of pace from the ancient history that we've almost exclusively focused on as well. So, I'm curious anyone's thoughts on that idea, if anyone would find it enjoyable at all. Otherwise, I am back to business as usual with our next regular episode, looking at the ramp-up to the Greek war with Xerxes, and the naval battles there at Artemisium and Salamis. There is a ton to cover just in those two battles alone, so we will see how everything pans out as I get those put together. Thank you for your continued support, crew. It's always a pleasure to have you aboard here on the Maritime History Podcast. Until next time, fair winds and following seas.